This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 19th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 130. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary, featuring Vancouver City Council virtual meeting bloopers. The Big Deal feature, The View from Victoria. I catch up with Tristan Hopper of the Capitol. I also check in with Dr. Roland Orferly of the BC Anesthesiologists Society, who is part of the team at Royal Columbian Hospital in the battle against the novel coronavirus. And I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those making a difference. Now, is it just me?
We'll do one more check. Sound check. Test, test, test.
I'm sorry, I'm still getting massive feedback. Could I have those instructions again? Okay, Council, we'll have a chance to test everybody when I do the call for the roll call. So I am just going to start, and then we'll just see how far we get.
Is it just me, or was the April 14th Vancouver City Council meeting the weirdest in the 134-year history of the city? Everything that could go wrong did go wrong with the WebEx video conferencing meeting that emanated from City Hall, which budgeted more than $35 million for information technology this year. It's the fourth time that Vancouver City Council has met electronically, but unlike the previous three meetings, this one was riddled with technical difficulties from start to finish. Mayor Kennedy Stewart and the councillors debated next steps in dealing with the financial impacts of the pandemic. Staff estimate at least $61 million in short-term lost tax revenue. Mayor Stewart has asked the provincial government for a bailout of as much as $200 million. City Council also debated how to proceed with public hearings beginning in May. The highlights ranged from the ridiculous to the sublime. Here are some of the good, the bad, and the ugly highlights and lowlights from the day's proceedings. The first voice you'll hear is City Manager Sidhu Johnston. Listen closely and you'll hear the meeting go down the drain.
Can everyone make sure to mute while they're while we're not testing the audio with you directly?
Point of personal privilege, it's Councillor Carr here.
Right, Councillor Carr, we're not quite reconvening, we're just going through a roll.
Okay. Is there a problem, Adrian?
Yeah, just that somebody's typing, so I can hear that too. The feedback is less, but the typing is still there, if somebody could make sure.
Okay, yeah, everybody, please mute your phones if you can, please.
And your toilets.
Councillor Dejanova, are you on the line?
Okay.
Councillor Fry?
Folks, we need everyone to mute your phones. We're hearing water in the background.
And giggling.
That's a nice way of describing it.
I know. I was trying to.
Someone is doing council business on the toilet.
Okay.
Okay, we'll start again.
We're being broadcast right now, folks. So,
Councillor Carr, are you on the line?
I don't know.
And we're just trying to do a roll call here.
This is a whole new territory for all of us, clearly.
Great. Okay, City Manager, we're trying to get through a roll.
Mute your phones, maybe we'll be ready to go pretty soon here.
We're trying to get through a roll call. Thanks very much, Council. So we have quorum, and as I said, I'll just go through the plan for the day, which is, again, my apologies. My home internet just totally collapsed, and so I was unable to do anything, and now I'm here in Council Chambers. With the clerks properly physically distancing from one another.
One of the council members was caught doing personal business during the council meeting. Listen closely.
Okay, thanks so much. On to Councillor Hardwick. Go ahead. Up to 5 minutes.
Thank you. I understand why this test idea has been put forward.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
sorry,
I can.
I just had some feedback there. Thank you. But I remain concerned that we are acting precipitously on this, and I'm further concerned.
Thank you, and then I can pay it by phoning or something.
Point of personal privilege.
Yeah, sorry, there's
Councillor Dominato.
Can somebody mute their phone? Everybody, if you could mute your phone so we can hear Councillor Hardwick, that would be appreciated. I'll stop your timer, Councillor Hardwick. I'll just have the clerks check on the muting. It sounds clear now. Please go ahead, Councillor Hardwick.
So I just also, I understand the test. I still think it's being rushed, and I'm concerned that we're putting the path of the development projects ahead of the interests of the people of our constituents, and I'd ask people to be thinking about that.
There were also several recesses that were called to deal with the sound problems.
On to Councillor Boyle.
Thanks, and I was just going to echo the Lord President.
Sorry, we're having a hard time hearing you too, Councillor Boyle.
Point of parliamentary procedure is Councillor Dominato.
Yes, Councillor Dominato.
I know that I can move when it's relevant at this point. I do think we need to move a recess to ensure that all councillors can participate if we're having technology problems.
We're just going to... Somebody's typing furiously. Need to mute your phone. Or mute.
Very echoey.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at the screen and hardly anybody is muted. So please, everybody, mute your phones.
They were all muted a second ago. Someone keep resetting it.
Finally, about 12 hours after it was scheduled to begin, the meeting came to an end.
Great. Okay, Council, I think that's it. No other folks on the list, so could I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Thank you. We have a seconder.
Second, Councilor Carr.
Okay, thank you very much. All in favor say yay.
Yay.
Yay!
Yay. All opposed say nay. Okay, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, Council. Very, very much appreciate it. We will see you tomorrow at the in-camera session at 1 o'clock, I think. Won't see you tomorrow,
thank
but
you.
We'll hear from you. Yeah. Great. Thanks for the great work tonight. Thank you very much.
You too.
Thank you very much.
Great. Camera. Nothing better than that.
Those were highlights and lowlights of Vancouver City Council's April 14th virtual meeting. Vancouver City Council is scheduled to meet again virtually on April 28th. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. Finbar Birmingham and Sissy Xu in the South China Morning Post. Coronavirus inside China's Wild West, where mask machines are like cash printers. We are slap bang in the middle of a gold rush for this year's most sought after commodities. Masks, gloves, thermometers, ventilators, hospital beds, testing kits, hazmat suits, hand sanitizer, and goggles. And according to those involved in the scramble, there are no holds barred. More than 38,000 new companies have registered to make or trade face masks in China since the beginning of 2020, compared to almost 8,600 in the whole of 2019, according to Tianya Cha, a company registry. On a single day in March, the founder of law firm Harris Bricken, Dan Harris, spoke to three separate people who had each lost north of $1 million U.S. on mask export deals. Consultancy Tractus Asia has been working with U.S. state governor's offices to source medical equipment from China since February and named its sourcing project Pandemonium, quote, because it is literally chaos, end quote, said founder Dennis Meserill. Stuff.co.nz, Jacinda Ardern takes 20 cent. 3, 2, 1. Stuff.co.nz. Jacinda Ardern takes 20% pay cut alongside all her ministers and public sector bosses. The cut will last for 6 months and also includes public service chief executives. For Ardern, the cut will be worth roughly $47,000. In total, it will save roughly $2.4 million, with the bulk coming from public sector CEO salaries, which should save $1.6 million. Gigi in the Japan Times. Thick, small, bulky. Ebono masks arrive in Tokyo mailboxes. The distribution of government-issued cloth face masks that are to be provided to every household in the country in the effort to fight the novel coronavirus outbreak began in Tokyo on Friday. Post office mail delivery personnel dropped off two masks at each home, along with instructions on how to wash the protective items. The face masks cost about $2.60 Canadian apiece. The final price tag for the government will be around $606 million, including for procurement and delivery. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.news podcast. Wuhan Coronavirus Pandemic 2020. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. Douglas Perry in the Oregonian. Petition seeks to open Oregon hair salons to one customer at a time. Stylists say they're facing grave financial hardship. Many Oregonians can't stand what's happening to them. They're becoming increasingly hirsute. Their means are a mess. And now more than 29,000 Oregonians are pushing for a compromise between vanity and the common good. The petition, created by a woman named Kara Owen, claims that a stylist working while wearing a mask and gloves poses little to no risk of spreading the virus as compared to 20 or more people in a grocery store or 10-plus people at restaurants picking up food. Owen insists the survival of beauty professionals is at stake. Mike Carter in the Seattle Times. King County gets new glimpse into unreported cases of COVID-19 through first-ever swab-and-send home testing kits. Results of first-ever home testing for COVID-19 in Seattle and King County indicate infections are declining, but that there still may be thousands of residents infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus undetected in the community, according to a report released by the Greater Seattle Coronavirus Assessment Network, or SCAN, which has analyzed the first round of swab and send testing kits from almost 4,100 county residents. Overall, SCAN's data suggests that somewhere between 5 and 75 of every 10,000 King County residents are infected, with the best estimate being roughly 24 per 10,000 residents, or 0.24%. The report said cases were identified throughout the county. And check news. New restaurant opens in Nanaimo despite COVID-19. Since the first Big Wheel Burger restaurant opened nearly a decade ago, they've become a popular brand in Victoria. Plans for one in Nanaimo have been in the works for the past year and a half. It was supposed to open March 1st, but first construction and then the opening were delayed following the arrival of COVID-19. Nearly 7 weeks later, it's finally happened. The eatery is bucking a trend. 1 in 10 restaurants in Canada is expected to close because of the pandemic. And the headlines this week in the Breaker.News included: Wood splitter trailer removed from legislative precinct as RCMP corruption probe deepens. Vancouver City Manager cuts non-union pay by 10%. And BC government search under employee desks for N95 masks. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Last week, we featured the view from Bowen Island. This week's Skype destination is Vancouver Island for the view from Victoria, the provincial capital. Our guest is independent journalist Tristan Hopper. You've probably read him in the National Post. Tristan Hopper is now editor of The Capital, in-depth reporting and long-form journalism from Victoria. You can find it at capnews.ca. Like many at this time, Tristan is working at home. You can hear his bundle of joy in the background. I started by asking Tristan what the mood is around BC's capital region at this time.
I would say economically, it's probably not, like everything, just by virtue of being a government town, Victoria isn't getting nearly as hammered. So I can imagine, further north on Vancouver Island, you've got a logging town that was already in dire straits. Now they're in particularly dire straits. So the sense of just panic and doom maybe isn't as acute here. I would say, the two biggest things I'm noticing. Not as panicked economically, but there's definitely, I would say, the number one thing most Victorians would notice if they've been in and around the downtown area has just been the massive expansion of the homeless tent city. So a lot of the downtown homeless service providers, just due to social distancing, they couldn't run packed shelters anymore. So they cut their capacity by 50% or whatever. So all along Pandora, we've basically seen this huge tent city grown up, the largest that I think's ever been seen in Victoria, just over the past few weeks. So no one's downtown, no one can actually see it. So you've seen this massive expansion of a tent city. And you've also seen all the normal tourism businesses who would right now be entering their busiest time. They're not only shut down, but they've actually started fortifying their stores because crime has also gone up in the downtown. So a lot of these places, their windows are papered over. They've taken some sort of security measures and they've posted signs in the windows that say no cash or anything. So Yeah, you have businesses that they're all wondering how they're going to stay open. And if they get one break in, one shattered front window, that could be it. They're never coming back.
In this crisis, we're seeing the best get better and the worst get worse. We're seeing a lot of people digging down, and we're seeing philanthropy, but we're also seeing, as you said, the crime. We're seeing the social problems get magnified and amplified. Where do you think this is going to go for Victoria?
Long term, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that you're right. It sort of has all the things that we were just sort of putting off Canada wide, just like, oh, you know, one of these days we're going to, you know, not make sure that care homes are just a, you know, complete emergency state all the time. We never got around to doing that. So that's why we're getting holocausts essentially in Ontario and Quebec care homes. Haven't really gotten the same level here in BC, fortunately, but I don't know what's going to come of it. It's sort of hard to bet. I think, economically, I think there's going to be more businesses than we're comfortable with who don't come back in the same form. So I think right now it's comforting to think, oh, you know, these are just temporary, and, you know, it's better to lose money rather than lose lives. But I mean, restaurants particularly, they're low margin businesses. So we can help them with rent, we can help them with other things, but if you missed the Victoria tourism season, which you will, even if, say, best case scenario, we see a lot of these lockdowns are reduced by June, the cruise ship season, I can't anticipate that's going to come back this year. That's not going to come back till next year. So, I think there's going to be a higher number than we're used to of just restaurants and retail stores who just sort of go away and never come back. So, much worse than what happened after 9/11, the strongest businesses can remain, but a whole bunch of them just aren't going to be able to survive.
Yeah, the cruise ship industry is something which is on hold right now. We do still have some ships going between the mainland and Vancouver Island. I'm talking about BC Ferries, of course, and there have been concerns about day trippers and others moving back and forth between the mainland and the island, bringing the virus with them. That's caused a lot of consternation among the authorities.
I'd say that, yeah, that's probably when I just look at the emails I'm getting and sort of the discussion on our stories and web forums, I would say that's the number one concern, because we are an island. Vancouver Island is an island. So, I mean, if you use the Strait of Georgia and the Strait of Juan de Fuca, if you use the Salish Sea to our advantage, we can shield ourselves against any pandemic better than most. I mean, look at New Zealand. New Zealand is doing relatively well through this, and they benefit largely because they can really control their borders. They can see what's coming in, and, you know, nobody just passes through New Zealand by accident. The rest of the time, Vancouver Island's all, you know, open borders, welcome, refugees, anybody, you know, you're all welcome here. That completely switches 180 degrees when you get into a pandemic situation. So we had a recent letter where more than 30 mayors, including the mayor of Victoria, Saanich, Alert Bay, most notably, calling for stricter restrictions on ferry travel into the city. We had the Nanaimo MP, I'm forgetting his name. He sent a letter also calling for just, you know, no non-essential travel on the ferries. So basically anybody can go on a ferry right now. They can technically turn you away if you're showing symptoms. But as we know, that's pretty poor at stopping the spread of COVID-19 because most people who get it are not showing symptoms. So the symptomatic thing is almost completely irrelevant at this point. So, yeah, basically a lot of official calls for the BC Ferries to essentially bring us food, bring us critical workers, you know, basically a situation where if you're boarding the ferries, you kind of have to, you know, it's like taking air travel into Israel. You got to have a pretty good reason to get on the ferry. I think that's the model everybody wants to see, because I don't know how hyped up this is or not, but there's just a general sense that there's a bunch of people who aren't taking the virus seriously. They're just loading up their RV and they're going to come in here and hit us with the virus, because Vancouver Island has been spared a lot of the worst that you've seen in Vancouver. So There's only been about 80 cases so far. I think only one or two deaths. So if these trends continue, which they seem to be doing, Vancouver Island could come out of this as one of the safest places to be in Canada, particularly for being on the coast and being close to a major center such as Vancouver. So I think, quarantine is definitely on everyone's mind.
There's already a lot of pressure throughout North America in some spots. Some spots have the evidence that maybe we should start looking at how to reopen again. Of course, there's some parts in the United States, especially in New York, where that's going to be months away. But here in British Columbia, the numbers seem to have moderated, and that's where the discussion is and the pressure is, even though the authorities are not giving us any hints yet. But what is the mood over in Victoria about taking those steps forward to get the economy going again, to get the tourists coming again?
I haven't heard any official discussion. Maybe it's happening and I just haven't come across it, but I haven't heard, you know, any major voices come out and say, hey, we gotta figure out a plan for when this ends. And that's even from the most, you know, the standard people you would be expecting to make that case. The mayor of Langford, head of the Chamber of Commerce, head of the Greater Victoria Harbour Authority, all the usual business boosters, nothing out of them. I mean, whenever they get in front of a microphone or someone calls them up, they're just saying, okay, we're in the thick of it. We have to worry about saving lives and we'll worry about the economy later. But I mean, I could say just personally, I think provincial, municipal and federal officials would be well served in providing the public with a better sense of the information, you know, the data we would need before we could start to reopen, because what's going to kill the economy even more than it already needs to be is the sense of uncertainty. So if the government can come out and say, once we see numbers, if we see a case rate here, if we see this indicator, I mean, they obviously have those numbers. There's something they're watching for where they can start to loosen restrictions on the economy and on civic life. And we don't know what those are, so there's a whole bunch of businesses just sitting around not knowing whether we're semi back to work in June, whether they could invest in protective equipment and tentatively get back to work. So, I would urge any government agencies to just be much more forthcoming with that kind of information so we can plan for the future.
Yeah, you're in an interesting situation over in Victoria with the Capital Regional District, the patchwork of communities, as well as the differences in politicians. On one hand, you've got Mayor Lisa Helps in Victoria on the left side of things, and in Langford, you mentioned the mayor of Langford, Stu Young, who's on the right side of the spectrum, different ideas. And then, of course, you've got the seat of government, the legislature, the provincial government there, the NDP. And at this time, of course, they got a bit of a truce with the opposition. The BC Liberals are cooperating, but we'll see how long this all lasts, especially with the pandemic and the state of emergency.
Oh yeah, BC's winning, so it's easy to it's easy for everybody to get along and be generally supportive of the government when I'd say we're doing better, definitely among the major provinces. I mean, you could argue that Nova Scotia and definitely Nunavut is doing better than us, but considering, and this is something I've written about for the Capital. It's just considering that we were one of the first places to get it and to see it in a major sense. And considering that all that happened and BC was able to tame it, whereas it completely took off in Ontario and Quebec. Whatever caused that, I think people are generally happy with the way things are going. Yeah. But it's interesting you mentioned Victoria and Langford, because the contrast between I'm in Victoria and Langford, of course, it's just north. Langford has really taken COVID-19 by the horns. So I haven't looked at every municipal response across Canada, but I would say it's probably one of the most aggressive I've seen. So they were calling for travel bans long before that was being called for by the province. They cobbled together their own public health unit and their own testing unit. So they basically said, I don't think there's enough testing coming from the province, so we're going to do our bespoke Langford style testing. When you drive into Langford, there's signs everywhere reminding people to get tested, to do a self-assessment. They just inaugurated a new system which kicks in next week, where any store in Langford, all the staff have to be wearing PPE, so face mask and a face shield. They've worked on securing enough face masks so they can actually carry this out. I wouldn't be surprised if you see a public masking recommendation or order in the city of Langford. So just on everything, they've been ahead of the curve and really tackling this with both hands. As contrasted with Victoria, which I would sum up the response largely with just sort of passing resolutions calling for more action from the province. So very different responses and in the city. But I would urge anybody listening to sort of watch what Langford is doing and maybe take a page out of their book.
That was Tristan Hopper, editor of The Capital. Go to capnews.ca for in-depth reporting and long-form journalism from Victoria.
I did a volunteer stint, soup kitchen this morning. The poorest amongst us are being hurt by people who are hoarding. Grocery stores, surgical masks, sanitizers. So let me just say to those who are trying to exploit others, there must be a special place in hell, a special place in hell, a special place in hell for people like that. There must be a special place in hell.
That's from The Battle of Alberta. Jason Kenney sings Special Place in Hell by Anonymotif on YouTube. The frontline health workers in the battle against the novel coronavirus in British Columbia and beyond include anesthesiologists. They are more than the men and women with the medicine. I spoke with Dr. Roland Orfeli, who is the CEO of the BC Anesthesiologists Society and part of the team at Royal Columbian Hospital.
Anesthesiologists are specialist physicians who do as much training, for example, as surgeons. There's an undergrad degree followed by 4 years of medical school and then 5 years of residency training. And our role in the healthcare system is quite diverse. Everyone is familiar with our involvement in giving anesthesia for surgery, but we're also involved in pain relief for women in labor, chronic pain treatments, acute pain treatments, as well as resuscitation and critical care. And this is where the linkage comes in very closely with the coronavirus pandemic, because these patients can sometimes get quite ill, and as everyone knows, require intubation and mechanical ventilation. And those are procedures that anesthesiologists provide on a daily basis as part of a general anesthetic care in the operating room. So when this pandemic was arriving, one of the first things that health systems across the world did was ask their anesthesiologists to set up airway teams to be prepared for very high-risk intubations of COVID patients. And these were high risk not just because the patients were very sick with very low oxygen levels, but because the intubation procedure itself is the highest risk time for the virus to be spread to the healthcare workers. In fact, one study suggested that the anesthesiologist doing the intubation of a COVID patient is 6 times more likely to have the virus transmitted to them than the other healthcare workers around them. And the other healthcare workers in the room are about 3 to 4 times as likely to develop COVID as a regular member of society. So there's a lot of risk, both to these very sick patients, but also to the people looking after them. And what we try to do is make that procedure as smooth as possible and reduce the risk for everyone involved.
When SARS hit Toronto in 2003, there was an incident at a hospital where 11 healthcare workers were infected. It underlines the need for personal protective equipment.
And there were a number of patients who got quite sick and required intubation and admission to the ICU. And in one of those episodes, the intubation was rather difficult, and 11 healthcare workers were reported to contract SARS as a result of that one episode. So this is a risk that health leaders, not just in Canada, but around the world, have recognized. And the rule that came in as a policy very quickly after that was that the most experienced physician involved with airway management should be the one looking after the intubation for these high-risk patients. And that is anesthesiologists, because intubation and mechanical ventilation is something that we're doing every single day as part of general anesthesia care in the operating room. It's not, you know, it's not something that we take lightly, even though we do it every day. These situations, like with COVID, make the stakes much higher for everyone involved. And that's why, as the coronavirus pandemic was coming, we spent a lot of time working with the other team members to do training and to set up guidelines and to make sure that we were all ready as a team to do this as smoothly as possible.
COVID-19 has not hit BC as hard as it hit Washington State or Ontario, but health officials here are starting to talk about the light at the end of the tunnel. They're talking about scheduling the surgeries that were delayed. What does that mean for your members?
Yeah, so first of all, full credit to Dr. Henry and her entire public health team, as well as full credit to all British Columbians who've actually followed the public health measures, which have had such a positive impact in terms of bending that curve. And it's only because of those decisions by public health and those actions by British Columbians that we're in a situation where we can now start talking about doing more of the elective surgeries, doing more medical, looking after patients for other purposes that they've been waiting for now for several weeks. As we talk about ramping surgeries back up, though, some of the challenges that we are needing to look at, number one is the staffing. Do we have the healthcare workers, including our important nurses, the surgeons, the anesthesiologists, housekeepers, and others who are involved to do more surgery? So that's one of the questions. Do we have the medications that are required? Because the same medications that are required for general anesthesia are also being used for COVID patients in the ICU. Do we have the PPE? And so every time that we intubate a patient for general anesthesia, whether or not they have coronavirus, we now have to be very cautious because they could have asymptomatic coronavirus, which would then spread to the entire team in the operating room. And so we are using quite a bit of PPE that we might not have been using previously, the gowns, gloves, masks, eye shields, head covering, neck covering, booties, you know, the whole body sometimes needs to be completely covered to protect the staff members, especially at the time of the intubation before surgery. So there's a lot of considerations that have to go into this planning, and that's why we are looking forward to any opportunity that we can have to speak with the minister, speak with Dr. Henry, speak with the Ministry of Health, to make sure that we all have the same considerations in mind as we make decisions about how this is going to roll out. We all want this to happen. We want it to be successful. But we need to make sure that all the different considerations are thought about.
That was Dr. Roland Orfeli of the BC Society of Anesthesiologists. The Society's website is bcanesthesiologists.ca.
These are the things we know to prevent you from speaking moistly.
That's from Justin Trudeau, speaking moistly by Anani Motif on YouTube. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to firefighters in Squamish and with the BC Wildfire Service for jumping into action to battle the forest fire near Brackendale. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 19th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on April 19th in 1713, Holy Roman Emperor Charles VI allowed his daughters to inherit Habsburg possessions? In related news, the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor really an empire. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. PATREON.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.